But we are glad you are with us. We are happy to have visitors with us tonight. We have several who have come out our way, and really glad that you have chosen to come tonight, because we're beginning a special series of lessons in the month of September on Wednesday nights. If you have not yet picked up one of these yellow brochures, there's some at each of the welcome centers out in the lobby. And you'll see the speakers that we have planned for each Wednesday night and the topic. And I think you'll agree these are needed topics that we will be studying on the theme of powerful evidence for. If you have ever watched the TV show, and it escapes me now. What is it? Yeah, the crime scene shows. CSI, that's right. I couldn't catch everything you said there, but thank you. CSI, follow the evidence. That's what they always say. Draw the conclusions that you find on the basis of the evidence. And that's what we're talking about. Christianity is not a leap in the dark. It is a step of faith, but it is faith built on solid evidence. And that's what we're going to be seeing in each of these lessons. Tonight, we're really glad to have Jeremy Weekly to kick this off. He will be talking about powerful evidence for the existence of God. Jeremy is no stranger to us here at Central. He has spoken here a few times before. He was in our 2006 series, which kind of tells you how old he's getting. he's still a very young man. But he is the son of Nada and Everson. And of course, we know based on that, he's going to be good. But he is now the preacher of the West End Church of Christ in Knoxville. He has been there for about a year and a half. And he was before that the preacher for the Selmer Church of Christ in West Tennessee. And I really respect Jeremy a lot, because that was a difficult work for him to step into. And I won't get into the details of that, but if you'd like to know more, you know, I'll tell you about it sometime. But he really took on a challenge there and did a magnificent job at Selmer. And I know he's doing the same at West End. In fact, two of our young people who are now at UT are attending worship at West End. Sarah Higginbotham and Creighton Kellum are both going to be attending there. But Jeremy is married to Sally. I don't know her maiden name, not that it would make any difference, I guess. But she is a delight. Sorry that she couldn't come with him, but they have two children, ages 13 and 10. He is a graduate of Fried Hardeman, has a degree, master's degree in business, as well as a master's in ministry or divinity?
Ministry.
And as I told him, that those two together enable him to meddle in everybody's business now that he has a master's in business. But Jeremy, take over.
Thank you so much, Tim. I always love being here. I wish I could just come and just sit and listen to Tim. I love to hear him preach. You're very blessed to have Tim here. My mom and dad talk about him all the time and just what great lessons he has presented, what he continues to do here at Central. Thankful for the elders for allowing me to be here, and that's probably because you don't know me. there are some of you here tonight who do know me. You grew up with me, or you saw me at youth events, and you're like, he's a preacher, right? It's one of those things. But I believe in God. And part of the reason I believe in God, I know there has to be a supernatural being, because my parents are still alive after raising me, and they still look that young, all right? So you guys can pay me later. But I truly believe in God, and I think this is an important discussion that you are going to have through this month. Evidence for. Sometimes people look at Christians and they look at us like imbeciles, or they look at us like we are completely ignorant of facts in the world. And so what happens is they just think that we just kind of blindly believe in something. When in reality, the evidence that we have, when you truly just simply boil it down to the most basic things that we can find, when you really look at the evidence, all the evidence points towards God being real. But again, not everybody in the world has that perception. Tonight, what I want us to look at is I want us to begin to look at the evidence that God has given to us, some through scientific means, some through philosophical means as well. And then we're going to finish with looking at the moral side of things, why all of those things point to God. Now, tonight, everything that I say is probably a lesson that you've already heard, quite honestly. As I go through each of these four arguments tonight, as soon as I throw them up there, you're going to be like, I've heard that, seen that, been there, done that, heard that lesson 100 times. Great. I hope you have. And if you haven't, please listen. I only have enough time to present some basic things tonight. There's a lot more evidence, a lot more proof for each one of these evidences that are given that we could talk about and could have an entire seminar on. Matter of fact, we're bringing Brad Harrib to West End next year, and he's going to do exactly that. He's going to do a Christian evidences seminar. When we think about this, what I don't want you to walk out of here tonight with the idea is that I have given you ammunition. I want you to walk out of here tonight with the fact that I've given you information. Because no matter how much we can prove that God exists, if your attitude speaks differently, your argument is worth nothing. I think for too long in our country, we have been at one another's throats rather than trying to reason with one another's minds. And I think even Christians can be a little guilty of that from time to time, that while scientists or others, not all scientists, but some people look at us like we're imbeciles, then sometimes we might be guilty of the same thing, accusing scientists or accusing people who might really be searching of being imbeciles because they don't see things the way that we see them. So tonight, I don't want you to leave here with the idea that what I give you is a weapon. I want you to see it as information that you can then, in turn, with the right attitude, share at the right time with the people that you respect and people that you love that might see things differently than you, and try to have a reasonable discussion. And we'll talk more about why I said that towards the very end of our lesson. But before we go much further, I do want you to hear from somebody else tonight. I want you to hear from a person called Bill Nye. Many of you children grew up with this guy, Bill Nye the Science Guy. I grew up watching a little bit of him, and my children have seen a little bit of Bill Nye the Science Guy. But I want you to hear how he sees things as a scientist.
Denial of evolution is unique to the United States. I mean, we are the world's most advanced technological. So, I mean, you could say Japan, but generally the United States is where most of the innovation still happens. People still move to the United States. And that's largely because of the intellectual capital we have, the general understanding of science. When you have a portion of the population that doesn't believe in that, it holds everybody back, really. Evolution is the fundamental idea in all of life science, in all of biology. It's like, it's very much analogous to trying to do geology without believing in tectonic plates. You're just not going to get the right answer. Your whole world is just going to be a mystery instead of an exciting place. As my old professor Carl Sagan said, when you're in love, you want to tell the world. So once in a while, I get people that really, that claim they don't believe in evolution. And my response generally is, well, why not? Really, why not? Your world just becomes fantastically complicated when you don't believe in evolution. I mean, here are these ancient dinosaur bones or fossils. Here is radioactivity. Here are distant stars that are just like our star, but that are a different point in their life cycle. The idea of deep time, of this billions of years, explains so much of the world around us. If you try to ignore that, your worldview just becomes crazy. It just untenable, itself inconsistent. And I say to the grown-ups, if you want to deny evolution and live in your world that's completely inconsistent with everything we observe in the universe, that's fine. But don't make your kids do it, because we need them. We need scientifically literate voters and taxpayers for the future. We need people that can, we need engineers that can build stuff, solve problems. It's just really a hard thing. It's really a hard thing. You know, in another couple centuries, that worldview, I'm sure, will be, it just won't exist. I mean, there's no evidence for it, so.
I think one of the things that I find most interesting about this video is what he says at the very end. Did you catch what he said? That another couple of hundred years, our worldview, the biblical worldview, will not exist. I find that fascinating because we're talking about a couple of thousand years of it existing. And really even beyond that, existing, that there is a creator, that there is a God. And yet he proclaims that over just the past maybe couple of hundred years, as we have become enlightened in the areas of science, that is going to take precedent. The other thing I noticed, and I hope you picked up on this, is that he talks about developing a worldview. I guess the reason that this particular video hit home with me is because he talks to parents. And as a parent of a child who has come home from a public school system and has sat down and asked me about the Big Bang Theory and had discussions about evolution, that hits home with me. Because ultimately, in my household, I am responsible, my wife and I are responsible for training our children. And if my child doesn't come and tell me those things are happening, what are they learning? And what is the world teaching them? Part of the other reason we need to talk about this, because we might be sitting here tonight and saying, well, we don't have any problem with this. I mean, we believe in God. We believe in creation. So why are we even talking about this tonight? And what's interesting is Gallup poll has really, the past couple of years, or past several years, they've been asking the same question about evolution and creationism. And the graph that I have on the screen, you might have kind of a hard time reading that. But there were three things that they asked people. They said, in terms of how God and evolution mix, do you believe that God had, that he used evolution to bring mankind where they are today? Do you believe that God just created people pretty much as we are today? Or do you believe that evolution has done all the work? When you see this graph, the one at the very particular bottom is that humans evolved, but that God had no part in the process. And that's actually kind of a minority, right? It's the very bottom line. And so it's kind of small, and we're like, hey, you know, we like to see that, but Steve, notice it's creeping up, right? The top two that you see, the gray one at the very top, is the percentage of people who believe that God created humans in the present form. We say, yes, right? We're excited about that. But notice where it's going. The trend, and this is all the way to 2017, is starting to dip down. Now, there's a couple of times where we've come really close with the next one, and that is the line that represents the percentage of humans that have evolved with God guiding. A mixing of the two ideas. There's a lot of that going on in our world today, right? Trying to accept, trying to tolerate, trying to be more accepting of what people might think or how they feel. And so sometimes we will mix those ideas. If that graph doesn't concern you some, maybe this one will. They also, within this same particular survey, and the most recent data here is actually in 2014, they asked, okay, for those of you who believe in evolution, you're a flat-out evolutionist, how familiar are you with the principles or the tenets of the evolutionary theory or evolutionary laws, they might would call it, if they really truly believe it to be that. And when you look at it from 2007, which is the blue bar, to the orange bar, the evolution, those who believe in evolution, it stayed pretty consistent, between 41 and 42%. That's the numbers there. But I want you to look at those who believe in creationism. Now again, this is measuring is how familiar are you with the basic principles of creationism, that God created the world, that God created mankind just as it is today. In 2007, it was above or right around 50%. In 2014, in 7 years' time, it has decreased to 38%. I don't know if you like to read data like I do. That scares me a little bit. And I think that's the reason it's important to have discussions like this one. Whether you've heard it 100 times or you hear it tonight for the first time, it's important to understand what God has done, what God has blessed us with, how powerful God is. And that's not just saying, well, I believe that God is powerful, but understanding that God himself has shown us that he is powerful. Tonight, what I want to do is talk about the evidence for the existence of the God of the Bible. And I'm going to look at these four different arguments, and I'm just going to look at them basically tonight. Again, probably most of you have been through these arguments before. You've studied them in Bible classes. You probably could come up here and teach this better than I can tonight. But my job tonight is simply to present to you in a basic way the evidence for the existence of God. And over the next couple of weeks, you're going to delve into some more serious, more specific topics in regards to this idea that people really struggle with on an everyday basis, things like evil and good and suffering in the world. And so I hope that you'll come back and invite your friends to come back and hear some of those sessions. But as we look at this tonight, there are four basic arguments that are put forth that in essence prove the existence of God. The only one of those is not based upon empirical evidence, evidence that you can reason out and see and kind of understand and define. And the first of that is that's the ontological approach. And it is by far, to me, one of the most difficult to understand. And so tonight, I'm a pretty simple person, all right? This is the philosophical argument that God exists. And I'm not always the best at philosophy. You can ask Ralph Gilmore and Freed Hardeman. I didn't do too good when I went up against him. But the idea is, out of these four, this is the only one not based upon empirical evidence. It's the concept that God exists simply because there's a possibility that he can't exist. And some of the reasoning for this gets kind of murky. And so here's what I want to do. I just want to provide you with an alternate idea that everybody in here tonight would agree with, but that you couldn't prove, right? And that is things like love. You believe that love exists, right? I think everybody in here does. And you say, well, no, Jeremy, I can prove that love exists. Really? Show me love. What you can show me is the manifestation of love. You can show me the result of having that emotion or having that feeling, but you cannot objectify love. You can't present it to me. You can't touch it. It's not like this podium. You know, we try to around Valentine's Day, right? We have the heart-shaped boxes. I love you, and we hand those over, right? We try to do it that way. But love is something that all of us believe in. But it's not necessarily something to be fully grasped. Now, as Christians, we say, well, God is love. Yes. Yeah, that's based upon our faith in the Word of God and what we know about God. Take the Bible out of the equation. If you ask somebody, well, show me love, how are they going to do that? There's a movie called Contact. I don't know if any of you have seen this movie with Jodie Foster and Matthew McConaughey. And in that movie, which is based upon a book written by, I think, Carl Sagan that Bill and I talked about, there is this obvious stress between faith and science all throughout the movie. And at some point in time, Jodie Foster is playing a scientist, and she wants empirical evidence for everything. And they've gotten a signal from Vega, right? And so they've built this machine, and they're trying to decide who's going to go. And because she doesn't believe in God, she doesn't get to make the first trip. Well, that upsets her because she doesn't think that you should have to believe in God. Well, Matthew McConaughey, who's a person of faith, he's not the best demonstration of faith, by the way, but he represents faith in the movie, that they have this conversation one night. And he says, you know, she says, I can't believe that you can believe that God exists. And Matthew McConaughey's character says, well, I can't fathom living in a world where God doesn't exist. In fact, I wouldn't want to live in a world where God doesn't exist. And she said, well, how can you believe that when there's no empirical evidence? And he said, easy. He says, you loved your father, right? Now, Jodie Foster's father dies early on in the movie. She was very attached to him. She says, well, of course. And he utters these words, prove it. How's she going to do that? She can show the results of what she feels or what she has felt for her father, but to manifest love itself, it's an idea. But we believe that idea exists. So if something like love can exist and be real, and we all agree on that, why can't God? That's kind of the idea of that particular argument. But on to more solid ground for us, because I'm not the biggest philosopher in the world. The next argument is the cosmological argument. This is one of those that you're probably most familiar with, and it's the idea that God is the first cause. That everything is because God said, let it be so, right? God spoke the world into existence. This is also called the cause and effect idea, and as far as the proof for the existence of God. When we think about this in terms that we might come to understand a little bit better how people can struggle with this, I told you my daughter years ago, now they're enrolled at a Christian school now, but years ago we were in Selmer, Tennessee, and she was attending a public school. And she came home one day and they'd started talking about evolution. They started talking about the Big Bang Theory. And she said, well, Daddy, I don't really understand the Big Bang Theory. And I said, okay, well, in essence, here's what they're saying, is that before there was the earth and the universe and all these things that hold constant, the laws of nature and all those things, before that was, there was something that started it all. But we don't really know what that was. It was something came out of nothing to create this. And she said, well, that doesn't really make much sense. I said, exactly. It doesn't, because that's not really good science. I watched a TV program years ago called Curiosity, where Stephen Hawking, throughout the entire program, and I think this was the first episode of the program, basically spent the entire program proving that you don't need God. And the entire program was, we don't need God because we have all of these laws in place. We have gravity, and we have the first law of thermodynamics, and the second law of thermodynamics, and the third law. We have all these laws of nature that make sure that everything runs just like it should, and that over millions and billions of years, all those laws have come into being, and they've kind of collided at just the right time, and just the right place, and just the right amount in order to bring everything where it is today. And then he did something that most scientists wouldn't dare do. He tried to explain the Big Bang Theory in this one particular program. Now, afterwards, there was a Q&A based on that TV episode, and even the scientists sitting around the think tank table at that point said, we won't even go along with that. Here's what he said. He said, all of this order came from one moment of complete and utter chaos. And I'm sitting here thinking, you just spent 50 minutes out of a 60-minute program explaining that everything is like it is and that we don't need God because everything is in just the right order. And then your proof for how all that came to be was a huge, massive moment of utter chaos that nobody can even quantify, that nobody can even explain. It's the Big Bang Theory. The problem with the Big Bang Theory is there's not a whole lot of bang to it, right? There's no way to explain the beginning. There is no beginning. But remember some of those laws. You don't create energy. Energy changes, but you don't create something out of nothing unless there's something outside of the laws of nature that creates that. You see, what Bill Nye says is naivete, or what he says is a extremely complicated idea for us, is pretty simple, isn't it? And it's proven in things like the first law of thermodynamics. It's proven in things like the law of gravity. And it is this. In the beginning, time. In the beginning, God, you know, that's source there. God created. He did something. He created the heavens and the earth. God. It's not complicated to me. It's not complicated whatsoever that there is a supernatural being who spoke all of this into existence, who lives outside of those laws, but has put them into place so that we can live the life that we live. That's not complicated. Trying to explain the Big Bang Theory is so complicated that nobody can do it, because you just can't. It defies everything. It doesn't make sense unless you have something that operates outside of the laws of nature, God. He is the source. The next thing that we see is probably the argument that you're most familiar with, and that's the teleological argument. And this is the idea, it's the argument based on when we see design in the world, whatever that design might be, that when we see design, that demands that there is a designer. For instance, in our world today, when you go and buy a glove at the store because it's starting to get a little bit colder, right? They probably have those out on the shelves now. When you go to the department store and you decide you're going to buy a pair of gloves, you go to Walmart and buy a pair of gloves, you know that that's going to fit on your hand, right? It's why? Because it's been designed for your hand. It's not the other way around. Somebody somewhere didn't create a glove and said, man, it'd be great to fit something in this, right? That doesn't make sense. Watches, and this is a hard illustration now because people don't wear watches anymore. But if you have a watch and you've ever had to open the back of that watch, and it's not a digital or a, you know, one of those kind of watches, it's like a real watch that has all the gears moving inside of it. If you've ever looked at those, no matter how cheaply that thing is made, it's a complex system. And the concept, the idea of evolution is that you took all of those hundreds of parts, little tiny parts and precise gears and mechanisms that have to work just so, and you threw it in a bag and you shook it up and you threw it out and you shook it up long enough, a whole long time, and you threw it out on the table and it just happened to all come together in just the right way, in just the right sequence, so that you could have a clock or watch, not only a watch that comes together, but a watch that is already on the right time and has been set and is ready to go, fully wound. That doesn't, nobody would believe that, right? Nobody in the world would say, yeah, you could do that enough times that maybe a billion out of a billion times you could do that enough that it would all fall together just right and that it would become an operational watch that was set on the right time and all that stuff was in the right place. That doesn't make sense. But yet again, that's part of what evolution says has to be. That over billions, millions, or billions of years, that what has happened is that all these little tiny things that have to all work together in just the right way, in the right sequence, that all of that has happened in over the course of billions of years. Not accounting for the fact that if that's really going to occur, then there are systems like the reproductive system that you can't have that develop over millions of years. That's not going to work and have a species be consistently around, right? I mean, that's common sense. But in the world of evolutionary science, that's the explanation. We talk about the teleological argument. There are a couple of things, and there are any number of passages we could look at, any number of illustrations we could look at. But consider this. In his book, in Brad Herb's book, Convicted, he mentions this. This is one of the things that he gives, one of the illustrations he makes. He says, consider the chance of Darwin's incremental steps of evolution explaining the perfection of these particular things in regards to, for instance, the Earth's position, where we are on this planet, just precisely away from the sun. Incrementally, can you explain how we are in just the right type of galaxy? Okay, let's start wide range. We're in just the right type of galaxy. Earth is in just the right position within that galaxy to sustain life, your life. That galaxy just so happens to have the right kind of sun at the right age to sustain life on this planet. It's in just the right position to the sun. And by that, what I mean is not necessarily how close or how far away we are, but even things like the tilt of the axis that the Earth is on. If it was incrementally off just few hundreds of inches, we would have major problems. Or the whole top hemisphere would be completely frozen all the time while the bottom roasted all the time. There would be problems. Can Darwin explain that there is just the right amount of water, both in the oceans and the seas and the lakes and all those things, and even in the air itself, can explain having just the right mix of the atmospheric conditions that we have? You see, all these things they're very complex, aren't they? Unless you have a designer who knows just what he wants and knows exactly what it is that we need in order to thrive, not just survive, but to thrive on the face of the earth. In 1981 Science Digest report, it was noted they were talking about the sun and the earth's revolving around the sun. And they said that if the earth departed only a ninth of an inch from the straight line that is on, that path that it takes, if it deviated by more than a ninth of an inch from that straight line every 18 miles, the entire earth would be incinerated. Now, I don't know about you, but I've built things before, and I guarantee you I was more than a ninth of an inch off. I was probably more than an eighth of an inch. I was probably more than 3/4 of an inch because it was my house, and I didn't really care. Not a big deal. Big deal if we're talking about the earth existing. We're really going to say that happened by chance. That just by chance, that all came together at just the right time over billions of years, forgetting how reproductive cycles even work. Let's just dismiss that the earth would have to, over billions of years, acquire all of this and end up in just the right spot so that we could evolve to be who we are today. That is complicated. God, a designer, an intelligent designer, knowing exactly what it is we need, makes a whole lot more sense. We think about the DNA, our DNA, and I think Tim not too long ago taught a lesson. Dad talked about it on the Human Genome Project. I won't belabor on that point very much, but just the fact that all of that has to be just so, and that one little tiny difference makes a big difference between my DNA and the DNA of a chimpanzee, right? Those things don't happen by chance. Those things can't take billions or millions of years to happen because it won't last. It's not sustainable. I think about what the psalmist said in Psalm 139 and verse 14. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. God is the greatest artist that I have ever seen. There are some great artists in the world, probably some great artists in this congregation. But if you've been to some of the places I've been on this planet, wow. And if God can do that with rocks and dirt, think about what He can do with human beings. We are the utmost of His masterpiece, so to speak. The pinnacle of that creation, the only part that is made in His image after His likeness, that's human beings. We are extremely complex beings, but we know that we have been designed by an intelligent designer. It gives us purpose and meaning for life. We'll talk more about that in just a minute. The psalmist says, "Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well." My soul. I think all of us, the ecclesiastical writer says that he has set eternity in the hearts of men. I think all of us deep down understand that there is much more to us than just DNA and molecules and blood and bones and ligaments and tissue and all of that. I think all of us, even an atheist would have to admit there's something more about us than there is the rest of creation, and that is by design, not by mistake. Romans chapter 1 and verse 20, God says, you want to know me, you want to see me, here I am. As Paul talks to those in Rome, as he writes to Christians there, he says, for His invisible attributes, I can't see God, I can't touch God, I can't hear God whisper into my ear, I can't talk to Him one-on-one, for His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived. Well, now wait a minute, what do you mean? What do you mean? He says, just look around. Ever since the creation of the world, in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. Talking about people who would choose not to believe in God, they're without excuse. When you look at all the evidence of what God has made, and as you just simply look at where the evidence leads you, is it possible for it to happen over millions of years by accident? Or is it by design? We could spend a lot of time on this, but we need to move on tonight. Because the last one, I think, is probably, to me, is the most powerful argument of all. And it is the moral argument. The moral argument seeks to prove the existence of God, because with any culture that you go to, there are going to be some things that are absolutely right. There are going to be some things that are absolutely wrong in any culture that you go to. I don't know that there's ever been a culture where it's been defined that murder is something that's acceptable. Now, murder differentiated from killing, the idea of murder with malice and intent, I'm going to go and take somebody's life. In what culture is that okay? I'll tell you what culture that's okay in. It's okay in any human culture who defines their morals by the standards of mankind. You say, well, what do you mean by that? Either morals are from man or they're from God. There's really only two options. We don't go to dogs and find morals, okay? We don't do that. I love my dog, but I don't love my dog like I love my wife, okay? I definitely don't love my dog like I love people. But I love my dog. But I'm not going to ask my dog, hey, you know, what's a good moral standard, Bella? Can you tell me what a good moral standard? I'm going to get the same thing you're going to get, a lot of panting and just looking at me and twisting the head, right? We don't go to animals to find morals. So we say, well, it's got to be either man or God. What happens when man is in charge of deciding what is right and wrong? You have things like this. Auschwitz. It's a picture of Auschwitz, one of the camps, to use a nice word, that was set up by the Nazi regime in Germany. To deal with what? To deal with the Jewish question, right? The Jewish question, don't call them people, just call them Jews. This is what happens when men decide what is right and wrong. When man becomes the authority. You see, somewhere, some way, a group of people had to convince an entire nation that there was an entire group of people that they could blame and that they ought to exterminate. How do you get there? I don't know, but we're awfully close to it, aren't we? You say, "What? We're not." I think you know where I'm going, right? Abortion. There are people my age, there are fewer of us than there should be. Because right around the time that I was born was where they started legalizing abortion in the United States of America. There are a lot of people that should be my age alive in this world today, but they're not because somebody somewhere decided they were not a person. Men voted and said, that baby is not a person. You see, when men are in charge of determining what is right and wrong, quite often we just get it wrong. Now, we do a pretty good job on most things. Laws of the land are pretty good for the most part. But the big moral questions of our time, just quite honestly, we don't have the best track record on as human beings. So when we talk about that, where do we find truth? And this is the moral question in essence. What is truth? Can you define truth? If you have God, you can say there is absolute truth. If you remove God from the equation, the only other possibility for morality you have is man. And we've seen over and over again in the history of mankind himself, whether you're looking in the Bible or just looking in the documents and pages of history, we are not good at that. But God is. And God is consistent. And so when Jesus is here on the earth and in John 17, when he prays, Father, I want you to sanctify them in the truth. He says, I don't want them to guess what the truth is. I want them to know that your word is the truth. I want them to know that. God makes sure that John is inspired to record those words so that you don't have any doubt. And if we had any other doubt, we could all go all the way back to the book of Psalms, right? Even before that. The sum of your word is what? Truth. God does not lie. God cannot lie. Every one of your righteous rules endures forever. If God is the moral standard, then you're going to make the right decisions. When God is not the moral standard, the track record for us is not so good. The moral argument to me is one of the strongest arguments that we have. Because it allows us to be able to know, to define, to agree upon what is right or what is wrong. But if God is not the standard for that morality, then it's just up to you and me. And I don't know about you, but I don't want that to be the case for my life. I want to live by a standard that doesn't seem to change every other week based on what somebody said or what somebody voted on. I want to know what it is that God wants or what is expected of me in this world. And God, in his infinite wisdom, has communicated that to us. So why does this matter? Like I said, many of you could probably have presented this much better than I did tonight, but why does this even matter? Well, here's why this matters, and it's something that Bill and I talked about. As he talked to people like me who are parents, he says, look, don't teach your children that fluffy stuff that you believe about there being something other than God because your world is too complex, it doesn't make any sense, it's a fantasy world that you live in. Don't do that because we need them. I'll tell you why this matters, is because he's right. We do need your children and grandchildren and generations to come. We need them. But we need them to know the truth. We don't need them to listen to all the scientists of the world who would say that God and science don't mix. God created science, by the way. God's not against science. He created it. But why does it matter? Because it formulates your worldview. You see, what you believe about the existence of the world and how the world came into being and how the world is and what it means to exist, all of that matters because it formulates your worldview. And your worldview matters because it's based on your origin of life. If life is just, you know, we just kind of happen to be, we ended up in somewhere in the process, I ended up being a human being instead of a fish, because we're all just kind of from the same primordial sludge anyway. I just so happened to accidentally become a human being. How valuable is human life? It's not, is it? It's not. And people become like animals. Well, he's old. He's not much of use anymore. Just put him down. You see, your origin of life, is there intelligent design? Are we different from the rest of the world? Are we made with purpose? That matters. It matters in how we see one another. It matters in how we treat one another. You see, if my worldview is that God created you in his image, I should see you differently. That's how it makes it possible. When Jesus says, love your enemies, that's how that makes that possible. Our purpose for existing, your worldview matters because it tells you why you're here. You know, if I'm just primordial sludge that just happened to end up being Jeremy Weekly, then that's a pretty big chance. Well, who cares? No big deal. Moral compass. What's right, what's wrong? Not just what's right or wrong for me, but what's right or wrong for humanity. What's the right thing to do? Reason making. We are losing this in our world today. People want to argue based on emotion, not reason. If we could all just stop and think rationally for a minute, a lot of discussions that we're having problems with, we could probably resolve, not easily, but we could resolve them if we would all just sit down and just use our brains that God gave us that are designed to work that way. And it also matters for ultimate ends. You see, if I'm just primordial sludge that happens to exist for a little while, then I'm just no better than a computer screen. I don't know about you, but the computer that I started working with when I started my job at Freed Harbor University, I almost guarantee it's in a dump somewhere, right? Never to be seen again. I'm pretty sure they couldn't even recycle that thing because it was a huge, massive, clunky, heavy thing, right? It's of no good. It's no good. It's no use. Technology has changed. You see, if I just believe that I'm just here for a little while and I'm just here and then I'm gone and there's nothing more because there is no God, what do I really have to live for? What reason do I have to exist or to continue to exist? What difference can I possibly make if all the time I have is this time right now? You see, for Christians, we believe that there is an ultimate end, but not like those who do not believe in God. We believe that there is going to be a change. We believe that we will exist eternally. We believe that we're going to exist eternally, either in heaven or in hell. Now, folks who are atheists have, to me, an easy way out. When I'm done, I'm done. One and done, and I'm out. For Christians, life becomes a little bit more meaningful because we have to make decisions now that we know that will affect us eternally. But to me, it's a much better way for us to live. It's a much better reason to live. And to know that whatever happens in my life, sometimes I may not be able to reason it out. But because I believe in God and I believe that He has intelligently designed me and has intelligently designed all of this, that He's got to care. And one of the number one ways, the number one way that He showed me that He cares is that He sent His Son to die for me. That blows my mind still. I don't understand that. I don't understand why God or how God could love someone like me who can act so unloving sometimes. But that's because He's God and I am not. And I'm thankful for that. Tonight, perhaps in your mind, you came and you thought, well, I want some good, really good, hard scientific evidence. I'm not a scientist and I'm not going to pretend that I am one. I can point you in the right direction for some more scientific evidence. You thought, well, I'm going to get this great philosophical argument to take and bash people at work with. No, I'm not a great philosopher either. I'll tell you what I am. It's a person who can use my brain and my heart to reason and come to understand something about a being who is beyond me. Someone greater than me. Someone who is in control. Someone who has the answers. And because He loves me, He has communicated what I need to know very clearly in His Word. You see, one of the other things that I think proves the existence of God is if you ask the question, if there was a God and there was a heaven, how would God communicate to us to make sure that we end up where He is? And we have that answer. He gave us His Word. He made sure to write it down. From beginning to end, He made sure to let us know how much He loves us and what He's done for us. He's told us the reason all that had to be done, and He's told us what we need to do to respond to that. And maybe for you tonight, it's time to respond. Maybe for you, you're not a Christian, and as we've talked about this tonight, you're like, well, you know, I still don't know. I encourage you to continue to study. Maybe tonight you came and you said, well, you know, I want to hear about this, but I'm not real sure about it. Maybe some of the things that we've talked about, you said, you know that, yes, God has got to exist, but now what does He want of me? What does He expect of me? That's where the real journey begins, right? Looking into His Word. Part of that journey is that He wants you in faith, as you believe in Him and trust in Him, to find out what it is that He said that we need to do in order to know that heaven is going to be our home, because that's really what God wants. God doesn't want to keep you out of heaven. God doesn't want to punish you and keep you away from Him. God wants you to be with Him. That's God's desire. That's His number one desire, is for you to live with Him for all eternity. And so when Jesus was here on the earth, He taught us about it. Even after He's died and been buried and resurrected, before He goes back to the Father, He makes sure to share with the apostles what He wants them to go and do. And what is it? He wants them to go and teach all the nations, right? He wants them to baptize people in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. He wants them to teach the things that He has taught to them to the people that they're going to go and see. God wanted to communicate what is necessary to know that heaven is going to be your home. By design, He did that in a way that we could either accept it or reject it. Tonight, either you accept it or you reject it. Either you accept that God has told us there are things we need to do in order to make sure that heaven is our home, you're going to do those things. You've heard the Word of God. You believe in it. Now, what are you going to do with that? You're going to change your life and live for Him, live with the right purpose? Are you going to be willing to confess that you really believe that Jesus Christ is Lord? Are you going to be willing to be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins? Because that's what Jesus told the apostles to go and teach, and that's what they teach on the day of Pentecost, and that's what they proclaim in Acts chapter 2 and verse 38. Are you going to do that? Or are you going to stay on the fence? Tonight, that decision is yours. Maybe tonight for you, it's not about physical, empirical evidence. It's about simply knowing that God knows what you're going through. Over and over again in the Scriptures, we find people who are struggling with real things, things that you're struggling with. And when they cry out to God, God makes sure to let us know that He hears those things. And part of the way that we know that is manifested in the people sitting in the pews here with you today. Because God in His infinite wisdom designed the church. He doesn't expect you to do this alone. He wants you to have brothers and sisters in Christ to lean upon. And maybe for you tonight, that's how your perspective needs to change. You've not yet trusted these people. You've not yet trusted that what God has told you you need to do. And maybe tonight, that's where the evidence is leading you, is simply to trust Him, to either take that first step or to be restored or to just cry out to know that He is there. Tonight, the evidence is clear. What will you do with it? And tonight, if you need our help in any way, we invite you to come while we stand and as we sing.